The following is a CNA podcast.
Welcome back to The Climate Conversations. I'm Jamie Ho. This week, we're talking about the food we eat and the agriculture that's needed to keep us going. The more there are of us, the more we consume. From the nature of our diets, to where our food comes from the carbon footprints of that steak, to the water that's needed for a glass of almond milk. How do they all add up to our understanding of agriculture's impact on the environment? And what does it mean for climate change? And as weather gets more extreme, how does it affect the very notion of food security? Talking to me today is Janice Lee, who is an assistant professor at the Asian School of Environment at the Nanyang Technological University. She is an environmental scientist with interest in the areas of conservation biology and agriculture. Janice, welcome and thanks for being here.
Thanks, Jamie, for having me here.
Well, I'll get straight to the first question. We've spent past episodes of this podcast talking about carbon dioxide, obviously. But let's start big picture. Paint us a picture of just how large a carbon footprint agriculture actually has.
Agriculture uses half of the world's vegetated land. It occupies a huge amount of land. And also, agriculture and related land use change, it generates about 20 to 25%, about a quarter of global greenhouse gas emissions. Energy consumption is still the largest, but agriculture, forestry, land use change, they come in a close second. I pull out some numbers. In 2016, World Resource Institute had shown that the annual emissions of the world is about 49.4 gigatons of CO2 equivalent. Agriculture, forestry and associated land use change came up to be about 9 gigatons CO2 equivalent. It accounts for a large amount of the global greenhouse gas emissions from anthropogenic sources.
Paint a bit of a picture as well in that I think there's a sociological picture to be told in that how we have sort of modernized, our diets have changed, even agricultural practices have become far more industrial in recent years and decades. How has therefore agriculture also evolved in this time that has led to it being such a large contributor to carbon emissions?
If we look into man's relationship with food, I mean, previously we were all hunter-gatherers, we lead a more nomadic lifestyle. And then big changes came in the agricultural revolution where we started to cultivate and domesticate crops and also animals and livestock. And then when we had more knowledge about like cross-breeding, improving the traits of animals and plants for our own consumption, new technologies like crop rotation, plowing techniques, these all led to improved productivity of food, of crops, and also livestock. I think the major change happened during the Industrial Revolution. So modernization of agriculture really ramped up during that period because you use a lot of machinery, you use a lot of inputs like fertilizers and also pesticides. There's a greater intensification of labor. Also, during the colonial regimes, you know, they moved people, they moved crops, they moved animals from one place to another. So that had really revolutionized the agricultural sector, the livestock sector. Diets have also changed greatly from more plant-based to more meat-based consumption. So when we look at, as countries increase in wealth or incomes, people also tend to move towards a more meat and dairy-based diet.
Yeah.
These are some of the major changes that have taken place in terms of men's relationship with food and also the agricultural system. With agriculture these days, a lot of our production is also concentrated in big businesses and industries. In terms of men's relationship to the land, the kind of subsistence agriculture, these kinds of relationships have also changed to one that's more supermarket oriented, where we source a lot of our food from things which are already packaged and processed.
I want to talk a bit about meat. I'm glad you raised the point, and it's quite self-evident that we are becoming more meat eaters than we probably used to, or at least our ancestors. Maybe use an example, whether it's dairy or beef. What is the carbon footprint from start to the time it gets onto your table? Because people talk about it being very carbon intensive, but I'm not sure people get the whole sense of the whole process.
Yeah, I think that because we are living in such urban, modern lifestyles, right, especially in Singapore, everything that we get are from the supermarkets, right? We don't see the whole process of how food is being produced. If we think about our food that comes to Singapore, most of it is being imported from distant countries. So if we take the example of beef, which is basically the most carbon-intense kind of food product that is out there, right? We have to take into consideration, firstly, the land that is being used for producing the livestock. So where the cattle is able to graze on, and also consider what happened to that land before the cattle came. So perhaps that land was full of trees, and so when you cut down those trees, you basically already emit carbon from those trees.
And you remove a carbon sink as well.
Yes. So then you bring the livestock there to graze, and you need to provide grass for these cattle to graze. So to increase the productivity of the land, in order to produce that grass, you also need to add fertilizers to the land. And so the production of fertilizers itself is also a pretty carbon intense.
And feed for the animals, I
would
imagine.
And also feed, yeah, exactly. So apart from the land that is needed to provide for the animal, you also need to provide land that needs to grow the feedstock that goes to the animal. When we think about livestock production, it actually accounts for more than 2/3 of the agricultural land around the world. And it's a very inefficient source of calories. So apart from it having the major stake in terms of the extent of land for agriculture, the amount of calories that it produces is only about 18% and also about 30% of the world's protein. So it's a very disproportionate kind of food product that comes to us as a consumer. And I think we don't see a lot of these effects that
I mean, if you put it that way, then even things like dairy and milk and cheese by logical calculation would be even more intense.
There are ways that you can compare these kinds of products. Anything that has to do with cattle always has got a higher carbon emissions, mainly because of the fact that we're raising cattle. There was a recent article published by Carbon Brief, and then they were ranking the average CO2 equivalent per kg of the product.
Okay.
Right. So when we look at beef produced for beef's sake, so for consumption, that comes up tops. So that's about 60 kg CO2 equivalent per kg of the product. And then I think a close second is, or not a close second, in fact, it's twice the amount compared to sheep and mutton, which is about 25 kg CO2 equivalent per kg of that product. The next comes cheese, like what you mentioned, dairy products. And also, I think, raising cattle for dairy, like milk.
Okay. Right?
Anything that involves the use of cattle has got a very large footprint, mainly because cattle takes longer to grow and you need to have that land available for that longer period of time compared to sheep and also other kinds of livestock. So dairy products, you know, these also have got a high carbon footprint.
It sounds like I'm making a pitch for either pork or chicken, but I'm sure they have their own footprints as well.
Yes.
you know, when it comes to agriculture as well, I mean, talk about emissions from the livestock in this particular case, something which we alluded to, and I think we should talk a little bit more about, is also about land clearance and deforestation. Of course, firstly, when you remove it, as you say, that's already an issue, but it also makes things worse. How have economies progressed to address this issue? Are they making agriculture more efficient given the land that they have had to clear for that?
So land clearance is a very major conundrum because when we look at the food security agriculture issue, you have three gaps that's identified by a World Resource Institute. One is the amount of people that will be coming into the world, right? By 2050, you have this number of people that you need to feed. And so then you have to increase in terms of calories for feeding these people. The second is the land scarcity issue, which is related to your question. And in this case, you need to increase the amount of land that's needed to feed these people. And then thirdly, you also need to ensure that as you increase in agriculture activity, you are able to mitigate the greenhouse gas emissions from this agriculture activity. Entering into the food security and also the agricultural debate, it's a very challenging one. It's full of conundrums. It's full of big challenges because you are expected to produce more calories. You're expected to do it in a much more efficient manner. When we look into the future of agriculture and trying to find land to be able to increase production, the truth is that, you know, there's very limited amount of land for production, and you also have competition of that land, either for conservation or for urbanization. So that's one issue that you need to look into. And another thing is about the efficiency of agricultural production practices.
Exactly, yeah.
In terms of increasing efficiency, people are looking into what are the alternatives for farming systems, what are the ways in which we can identify inefficiencies in our agricultural systems, what are the ways in which we can still manage to produce as much, but with less inputs, for example, or less carbon-intense activities that go along with the process of producing the food. You need to really take a very big systems approach to understand how can we try to drive up agricultural production, yet at the same time, minimize our effect on land and also greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, I mean, and one of these issues which comes up every now and then in our part of the world, especially when you get the haze, is the role of palm oil too. And that's, again, another huge part of agriculture. Explain as well for people just how prevalent and how used and how widespread palm oil is. I don't think people know. It's basically in most things that we eat, even in our shampoos and things like that. And how do you balance the fact that it is a very lucrative resource for countries that have palm oil plantations? And what's being done to sort of mitigate the effects that either you clear land for these palm oil plantations, but also the process of producing the palm oil?
So palm oil is really one of the many crops that has really shown up as a alert, right? Because of its association with deforestation. While we recognize the historical deforestation that's also associated with palm oil, we also need to be aware that the use of palm oil is very popular also because it has got very high productivity and it's also a cheap oil. So if we compare, you know, 1 hectare of land for producing vegetable oil for palm oil compared to rapeseed or soy, it's about 3 to 4 times more in terms of yield. So that's why people still prefer, in some ways, palm oil, because it's got very high efficiency for land. The problem is where that land is, right? So if we're looking at soy, or at least like rapeseed, you know, it's grown in more temperate regions, but palm oil can only grow in tropical, hot and wet regions. And that's also exactly where you have biodiverse and also carbon-rich landscapes, which could be destroyed in the process to lead to the production of palm oil. It's challenging to balance the importance of palm oil also for economic activities, for livelihoods of farmers, and also for the economies of countries like Indonesia and Malaysia. In fact, even Singapore also benefits from it, because that's also where we have a lot of big companies trading and also involved in the process of palm oil production. What the industry has shifted more towards is to increase in transparency and also traceability of the palm oil. And, you know, one of the mechanisms that sort of facilitate or move that process is the certification system that was being developed for palm oil, which is known as the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. So this certification system came up because NGOs, the industry, the governments, they came together to look into ways where we can improve palm oil production and yet at the same time try to mitigate the negative effects on the environment, on deforestation, on carbon emissions, and also social impacts, right? Also not neglecting the people who are living there, the farmers, the indigenous communities whose lands are being used for production as well. This certification system basically standardizes practices whereby if you follow a set of rules, these rules will ensure that your palm oil will be moving towards a less environmentally destructive way of producing it, a more socially responsible way of producing it. There are pluses and minuses to this scheme, like with every other, you know, sustainability scheme that's been introduced. RSPO began around 2004, 2007. You have the certification system also evolving over time. The hope is that more and more actors in the oil palm industry and also within the supply chain, so not just the actors that are producing palm oil, but also the actors that are financing palm oil, the actors that are consuming palm oil, the actors that are trading and processing palm oil, will get on board such that there's a shift or transformation of the industry so that all actors on the ground will abide by these, you know, environmentally and socially responsible ways of producing palm oil. So this is what we are seeing in the palm oil sector. In some ways, it is better than business as usual, but it's still not a perfect system. There are still problems related to it. There are still complaints related to this certification system. But in some ways, it is a step forward.
In a way, though, then do you see it as inevitable, or some may say even necessary and useful for even like markets, right? Like the EU putting the kind of pressure that they do on places like Malaysia on the issue of palm oil. Is that always going to be the case that you need outside forces to sort of pressure domestic producers to meet these certification or levels of transparency?
The best way would be that producing countries would see the value and also recognize the importance, right? It's not that they don't, but they do face a very big challenge because these countries also have large aces of people they want to live out of poverty.
Yeah, the conundrums as you were talking about just now.
Right now, in fact, countries like Germany, UK, they recently, very recently, pushed for a law to ensure that the agricultural commodities that they source are deforestation free.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's something that's pretty recent and something that, if passed, will then affect that pressure to producing countries to be able to change their practices, right? And also to encourage the governments to have more regulation. The challenge is that there are other markets that are willing to receive these products, yeah, which might be associated with deforestation. Yeah. So, for example, in the palm oil industry, you know, majority of palm oil from Indonesia actually goes towards India, right? Comparison of India's policies of sustainable palm oil to countries like in the EU,
it's very different,
right? There is a very big challenge, you know, that on one hand, there is pressure from the consuming countries to try to get the producing countries to move towards that pathway. But it could also mean that you displace that palm oil towards countries that don't have such stringent policies. So you do need a concerted effort. In some ways, having that pressure does help to get at least the companies and the private sector on board, right? I think in some ways, there could be, you know, these issues related to unfairness of policies, trade policies, and basically issues related to green colonialism. I don't know if you know about that. So I can understand why, you know, producing countries do feel that some of these policies are unfair. But yeah, at the same time, you know, it helps to encourage that dialogue and also that movement towards market transformation. The private sector is listening and also trying to also move towards that direction.
That's really the eternal question, isn't it? You always have either economies or institutions have varying standards and varying speeds at which they move, and how far markets react to that. That's going to be hard to deal with. I wanted to change our direction in our discussion a little bit and talk about food security. Obviously, it's a bit of a vicious cycle. You have greater weather extremes that comes with climate change. It also affects agricultural output for many places when that happens. So obviously, countries will, and societies will try to mitigate that by diversifying their food sources like Singapore does. But it also raises question to me, for example, if we are trying to raise awareness that we need to source our food from different places. Instead of getting eggs from Malaysia, we're going to spread it out and get it from different places as well. That in and of itself has a carbon footprint, and or at least a carbon signature too, in that as countries look towards other markets, and this will have to be imported. This is another conundrum that people face, I would imagine, because again, carbon footprints are going to go up.
It's a tough one, right? I think that diversification is at least Singapore's strategy, right? Also, it's something that we cannot not help do because we don't have the land to be able to grow locally. So Singapore does have an aim to be 30% food secure, right? Thinking imaginatively about how we can improve our food production locally is one strategy. By involving tech companies or looking into the limited spaces that we have and trying to grow food. So there might be some interesting breakthroughs or some innovation in that sense. In the long run, the strategy is still to consider diversification. If we look at other countries which maybe have that land to be able to produce, they could be diversifying within their country's boundaries. There needs to be greater studies going into climate risk. How does that affect agriculture? How would some of these climate risks that could be more severe, more problematic in the future, could it also affect us because we might be sourcing from those particular parts or landscapes in those countries? Diversification would mean that you would have to get food from other sources. And yes, that would mean that you have a high transport cost. It's also important to think about things in terms of diet shifts.
Exactly.
You know, in some ways, we cannot always be looking to the production side of the issue. What can populations in Singapore also do in terms of ensuring that we can reduce our food imports in the future?
Exactly. That's a brilliant point, because I'm going to end our conversation looking at individual actions as well. I'm just using eggs as a random example. You know, if I have two eggs, one comes from Malaysia and I know it comes from Malaysia, and I look at another egg, it comes from Poland, and I know that if it came from Poland, it probably had to be refrigerated on the plane. In the end, it comes down to individual choice and whether or not an individual feels empowered to firstly be aware and secondly then decide, actually, I don't want to eat that egg at all. I mean, that's like an extreme example. But as we end on a more positive note, when it comes to individual action, what's your sort of take in terms of our own awareness of the food that we eat, the products that we consume? What are the small steps or even big steps that individuals can take, since you also mentioned individual action?
Reducing our meat consumption is a very big one. Specifically, I guess, beef, pork. It's tough. I think in Singapore, we love our food.
Yeah, honestly, I love my steak as well.
Also, food is a very personal and cultural thing, yes. Right? So to give up something is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe reducing your consumption, or instead of having meat every day, having meat once a week, is that such a big challenge? Maybe you can start trying, you know, reducing the meat consumption. In fact, scientists have also come up with solutions or calculations of how we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions by reducing our diets.
Mm.
The first choice is to go vegan and then, you know, completely plant-based diet and then vegetarian, where you still have some maybe fish consumption.
Mm.
And then you have, you know, replacing, they call it flexitarian, you replace all your meat or dairy products with pulses and other kinds of non-meat products. Just also abiding by health regulations, national health regulations,
yeah.
Where you reduce meat and then you increase your portion of fruits or vegetables. That also can reduce greenhouse gas emissions. As an individual, I think it's about the diet that you have and thinking carefully also where you purchase your products, like what you mentioned. Is the egg coming from Malaysia or from Poland?
Mm.
Being more responsible and thinking a little bit more about where these products come from and what are the environmental and social impacts that are associated with these products. On one hand, you know, we want to advocate individual change. It's also important to bear in mind that systemic change needs to happen if we want to go anywhere to transform our agriculture and use change industries to become less carbon intense. Mm. So targeting companies and ensuring that there's greater and stricter regulations about where they source their products from, ensuring that, you know, these products don't come from deforestation or exploited labor, holding also businesses accountable along the supply chain, right? Not just the producers, but the financiers and also the traders and processors. Systemic change really also has to come in, you know, apart from individual change.
Janice Lee, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. Thanks for being on the Climate Conversations.
Thank you very much, Jamie, for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Climate Conversations. This is our fifth episode and is part of CNA's broader coverage of climate change. You'll find all our content on cna.asia. Hit to the orange bar that says Climate Change. You can also find this and other CNA podcasts on our website, app, and on iTunes and Spotify. The team behind this podcast are Crispina Robert, Lin Su Ling, Aaron Low, and Annabelle Deong. I'm Jamie Ho. Till next week.